This is Mame Warren. Today is June 18th, 1999. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland with the one and only Ross Jones. And I'm just real excited to be here. You came to Johns Hopkins as a student.
Right.
Why did you pick Johns Hopkins in the first place?
Well, I grew up in Haddonfield, New Jersey, and I had been editor of my school paper. I had worked summers as a copy boy on the Courier Post newspaper in Camden, New Jersey, which was nearby. And I thought I wanted to be a newspaper man. And so I, at the end of my senior year in high school, I enrolled, or I applied for admission to Rutgers, which was my state university, to major in journalism. I had a very dear friend I met in the seventh grade, and his father had graduated from the School of Public Health at Hopkins. And he was bringing his son down to see Johns Hopkins and said, well, why don't you go along for the ride? And I said, okay, but it's a pre-med school and I don't plan to be a doctor. He said, no, it's more than that. Why don't you come along? So I did. He made the first stop at the School of Public Health, where he visited his old mentor, Dr. McCollum, who was the inventor of, discoverer, I guess I should say, of a lot of vitamins, famous man in public health and around the world. And then we came to Homewood. And when we arrived at Homewood, my eyes sort of popped out because it looked like the kind of university I had always thought a university ought to look like. We met a young fellow who seemed old, but he had just graduated the year before from Hopkins and was in the admissions office, a man named Bob Biuno. And Biuno was very welcoming and took us to lunch at the Hopkins Club, among other things. And I still remember the corner that used to be called the ladies' dining room, now it's the Eisenhower room where we sat. And I thought, well, this is for me. This is the kind of life I'd like to lead, not knowing that undergraduates didn't go to the Hopkins Club. And so I applied on the spot, and both my friend Charles, Turtelot was his name, and I were admitted. And I passed up Rutgers and came to Hopkins.
And the rest is a very long wonderful history.
And it's 50 years ago this September, which it was in the fall of 1949.
So you arrived on campus in the fall of 49. That was kind of an unusual time. Were the veterans still
The veterans here? Were still here in large numbers, and it was a very interesting time. Because there were a group of us kids, 17, 18 years old, and then there was this other group of people who were a little older, but seemed a lot older because they had been in World War II. And you had a sense of feeling more, I think, a little more worldly in their company. And they sort of were take charge people. and we're fun to be around. The lacrosse team of 1950, which was the first lacrosse team I had ever seen, even though I lived 125 miles north of here, I'd never seen or heard about lacrosse, was a championship team, and on that team were many World War II veterans. And it was a wonderful way to be introduced to the game of lacrosse, to see them play.
So what did you think when you saw lacrosse for the
first
time?
I loved it. I was just taken with it. Big guys, hard-hitting. Not all big. Some of the midfielders and attackmen were on the smaller side, as was the goalie at that time. But the defensemen seemed huge to me. And they had big wooden sticks, and they clobbered each other. And used to be the crowd would say, give them the wood, meaning hit them with sticks. Today the wood's all gone, so I don't hear anybody saying give them the plastic.
So did you get involved?
No,
with lacrosse?
No, I didn't play any sports. Totally uncoordinated. But I was involved in the life of the place. I was secretary of my class in my freshman year. carried on my interest in journalism and became editor of the a co-editor with a wonderful guy named Frank Somerville of the weekly newspaper, the Newsletter. I was involved in a lot of other club-like extracurricular activities. I really enjoyed my time at Hopkins. I was not a scholar, and really wasn't preparing myself to go on to graduate school. I didn't know what I wanted to do. But Hopkins in those days, and I believe it still is, was the kind of place that you could do your own thing. And if you were lucky enough and inventive enough to find your way, to decide what it is you wanted to do, what you wanted to put your time on, it could be very rewarding. If you were looking for a much more structured existence where people told you what to do, academically, socially, whatever, I think it would have been very difficult for a lot of people. And I think some people came here expecting that's what a college would be like. But I didn't expect anything, and I found the freedom to pick my courses and pick my friends and social life was very rewarding. Although, as I said, I wasn't a scholar, and my grades weren't all that good. But I had a good time.
Well, that's a pretty important thing at that time of life, or any time of life. So you worked on the Newsletter.
Yep, worked on the Newsletter, and that was terrific. In my freshman year, a man named a kid then named Bill Zartman was the news editor. Bill Zartman has gone on to be a very distinguished professor at SAIS in African studies, and he would give me my assignments. I remember one assignment. I don't know whether he gave it to me or I made it up, but I went to the. There was a threat of a national coal strike. It must have been in the fall of 49 or early 1950. And I went to Whitehead Hall, and we used to burn coal in those days, had a steam plant there. And I went around and looked at the coal pile behind the building, and the coal pile seemed to me pretty small. And I was reading in the public press that we weren't going to be able to get any more coal. So I wrote a story saying that Hopkins would probably have to close in the next couple of weeks because we'd be out of coal. And that didn't go over too well with some of the people in the administration.
So did the Newsletter take a lot of your time?
Oh, I gave it a lot of time. As I went on, I think I became a managing editor. You know, you sort of go up through the ranks, and then I became, as I said, with my friend Frank, co-editor, and I spent a lot of time doing that. It was only a weekly. We had it printed at a German newspaper. There were still some German language newspapers in Baltimore at that time. And Thursday night, we would get all the copy in, and we would take the copy down to this German newspaper and stick it under the. Are we okay?
Yeah.
Stick it under the door for the printer, and then the next morning, about midday, we would go down. Earlier in the morning, we'd go down and we'd lay out the pages. With the old teletype. Linotype mm-hmm. machines, everything lead, and we'd lay out in these forms, and they'd run some proofs, and we'd check them out, and then they'd print it, and we'd bring the paper back and distribute it on campus. But Thursday nights also, we would, after we delivered the paper, we'd go out on the town, and my friend Frank had a big old convertible. His father was in the car business, so he always had a nice car, and we'd go out and enjoy ourselves in the city. It got pretty late, I remember, sometimes.
So what'd you do in Baltimore? What did Baltimore have to offer in 1950?
Well, Baltimore had the block. Baltimore had the block, and it had a place, this is at night now, on Thursday night, had a place out on out on North Avenue, adjacent to a railroad bridge called the Old Rail Inn. And the Old Rail Inn was a place that I would not enter today, and I wouldn't want ever want my children to enter. But it was a bar, and there were strippers. And we'd go in there. You had to walk up to the second floor to get in there. And we went most every Thursday night after getting rid of the newsletter. And the last time we went, the two fellows ahead of us checked their guns at the coat check. And so we decided that we wouldn't go there anymore.
So is this a Hopkins hangout?
No, it wasn't. It
would
was
ring
just
bells
a,
with
no,
other
just a,
people?
Just a few of
this
us.
This was your private place.
It wouldn't ring bells with but a few of us. Another place was Nate's and Leon's. I would say we went there more than the Old Rail Inn. Nate's and Leon's was a wonderful delicatessen on North Avenue. And it seemed to go all night. I don't know if it did or not, but we had some wonderful hot pastrami sandwiches and corned beef pickles way into the night.
So these days, I understand students are busy way into the night. Did that practice?
Well, we were. Oh, they were here too. They were here too. I mean, it was. There was a lot of studying.
So in the middle of the night when you needed some relief?
Well, there were places that you could walk to from here. Greenmount Avenue was still an area where you could go. And there was an all-night restaurant on 28th Street, I guess. 29th Street. And we would often walk over there at 1 o'clock in the morning and get something to eat.
Do you remember the name?
I'm trying to think of it. I just can't think of it right at the moment. Just can't think of it.
More importantly, do you have any pictures of it? That would be
no. I don't have any pictures of it.
Great.
No. It's where I think it's called the Blue Moon is now. I really think that's the.
The Paper Moon.
Paper Moon.
Yeah.
That's the same
that's
building.
A great spot.
Yeah.
And that's where the kids go today.
Yeah. Well, it was a real greasy spoon in those days.
All right. Well, I'll have to check in on that.
Yeah. Open House. The Open House Restaurant. That's what it was called. Yep.
That's a good name.
Yep.
All right. I'll have to check in on that and see if I can find that. So, you think we ought to talk a little bit about academics? Maybe you weren't a great student.
I wasn't.
But I'll bet there were some teachers who made an impact on you.
Oh, gosh. Sidney Painter in history. Comes to mind.
Sidney Painter.
Yes.
Tell me about him.
Well, I mean, he was I would call him a very tweedy gentleman. I don't think he ever wore anything but tweed jackets, lovely mustache, slacks, and a sport coat is what I remember mostly about him. Small, I remember small, almost seminar-like classes with him. Al Chapanis in psychology was someone else I remember very fondly. Wilson Schaffer was spectacular in abnormal psychology. I remember the first day that we had class with him, he said that as you read these texts and we have our classes, he said, if you don't find something wrong with you or is a little abnormal, then you better come see me because everybody's got something that they'll find in these texts about themselves, and you don't want you to worry about it. He said, that's normal, because if you don't find anything, then you better come see me. I was lucky enough to have Owen Lattimore for a couple of courses.
Oh, now, Ross, you've got to tell me about that.
Well, I mean, it was, a special treat. he was a fine teacher. He didn't have a PhD, and there was room for him at Hopkins. He brought from Mongolia, the leader of the what is the religious group? I'm blanking on that, but he brought a man who was dressed in Asian religious garb and would be here on the campus all the time. This would be this information would be available back in the archives. I forget I just forget what he was called, but he was a religious leader that I think fled from Mongolia. Or one of those remote Asian countries, and Lattimore sort of offered him haven here. But what I mostly remember about Owen Lattimore was the night that he came back from. I think he had been traveling in Mongolia, wherever he was out of the country in Asia when Senator McCarthy tarred him with the communist brush. On radio and television, and he was said to be a communist sympathizer, and he came back, and however long it took him to come back, and he was welcomed one, I believe it was on a Sunday night, in Levering Hall when all of the faculty came to stand by him, and. I was just literally out in the hall in the back, standing on my tiptoes to try to see what was going on. But I sensed the coming together, if you will, of the faculty to support freedom of speech and freedom to teach and those things that faculty support. One other time, I was on the campus. I had a 1936 Chevy. Which was used to give me fits, and the car just stopped in the middle of the road over near Latrobe Hall, and I think it was on a weekend, not many other cars around, and the first person to drive up behind me was Owen Lattimore, and he surmised that it was a battery problem and said, well, if I give you a push, I think we can get it started. So I got pushed around the campus by Owen Lattimore, and it did in fact start. And I always thought for a distinguished guy like he was to take time out for an undergraduate on a Sunday afternoon was pretty nice.
That's a tale worth remembering.
Another thing I might say about him was that there were members of the Board of Trustees who wanted him fired. Conservative members, I presume, and the trustees, my recollection is, now this didn't happen when I was involved with the board, but I was told, the trustees led by Charles Garland, who was a leader, I don't think he was chairman at the time, but did not do that, and I think to their everlasting credit. They stuck with him, and he eventually left and went to the University of Leeds. But we lost, again, the story goes that we lost a very large bequest from a man named Jacob France, who was a trustee, and that bequest eventually created the France Foundation, which is now part of the Merrick France Foundation. And it's interesting how those things come around. And certainly the Merrick France Foundation does a lot of good in this city and at Johns Hopkins.
What do you mean that Jacob France didn't give?
Because
of Owen Lattimore?
Yes. He was one of the ones who wanted Lattimore fired.
I see.
And he said, if you don't fire him, I'm leaving the board and I'm taking my bequest with me.
I see.
And that's the story. I think that's credible.
Uh-huh. Now, a few minutes ago you said that Owen Lattimore didn't have a PhD.
He did not.
But that Hopkins made room for
Yeah.
replacement.
Well, I think there were people like that. I mean, today I can't imagine taking on a faculty member without a PhD. Now, maybe we do, but there was a fellow in engineering named Bob Pond who's still alive and a wonderful guy in engineering. He didn't have a doctorate. And my recollection is that there was a handful of people like that. And it was just Hopkins is just a very flexible was, and I think it still is a flexible institution. And it was small enough, and I think it still is, to move in different directions, to start new programs, cancel ones that don't work. In my own studies at Hopkins, I had a major that doesn't even exist anymore called Life Sciences. And what it really did was it gave me carte blanche to pick and do whatever I wanted. I could just choose anything, and did. Took things all over the map. And loved it, and I don't know how that developed. My guess is, it probably developed to be helpful to the World War II veterans who were independent-minded and kind of decided what they wanted to do rather than fit into a mold that would be offered to them by the university. I don't know for that for sure, but it worked well for me. I was very lucky.
So what was it that made someone like Owen Lattimore special enough to come without a doctorate? What was he teaching? What did he
do? Well, he was teaching mostly about China in those days. And there was a special institute, and I'm forgetting its name. But it offered an umbrella for people interested in that field. And that's easily ascertainable from the archives. I just forget it at the moment. But that's where he fit in. I don't believe he was in a department, although he might have been in the history department also. I don't know.
Okay. Other teachers? Anybody else who really stands
out?
Well,
there. I think I've probably... I think they're the ones that just pop to mind right now. I mean, I got to know people after I came back to Hopkins, but who were here at the time that I was here. But I didn't know them as students as much.
So, you graduate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you went away.
I was in the ROTC here, and that was fortunate for any of us in ROTC in those 1950, 51, 52, 53 period, because the war had started in Korea, and had I not been in the ROTC, I would have been subject to the draft, but they let those of us who were in it. All around the country, stay. Some of the fellows who graduated just 1 year before I did went to Korea, and so 1 or 2 years before I did, then they had some pretty extraordinary experiences. My next door roommate, Tom Wood, my freshman year here, was killed in Korea. A very sad story. His father was an army general. His brother had gone to West Point. Tom wanted to go to West Point, but had lost a kidney at somewhere along the way, and therefore was not eligible. So he came to Hopkins, went in ROTC, went over to Korea, joined his brother's company somehow. And within 2 or 3 days, his brother sent him out on his brother was the commander. Sent him out on a mission, and he was killed. Mm. A terrible thing. And for many years, there was, I believe, a scholarship for Tom by his class. It was a class of 52. But there were other people. A fellow named Gatchell, I think his name was, was in one of the major retreat that took place in Korea. Very, very difficult wintertime thing. So anyhow, I just missed it.
So was there an undercurrent while Korea was going on campus?
I think there was a lot of concern about it. I mean, it wasn't like a Vietnam undercurrent at all. I think they were just concerned, would I get caught up in it? Mm-hmm. And so I felt very lucky, as anybody else in my class did, I'm sure, to have missed the combat. But then you still had to serve your time. And I was in the infantry and went over to, I first was at Fort Dix in New Jersey teaching machine gun, which really is, people can't believe that I ever pulled the trigger, let alone teach it. But I did. And then I thought I was going to go to Korea because still we had a lot of forces in Korea in 1953-54. But I was sidetracked to Japan. With the 1st Cavalry Division, and was on the northern island of Hokkaido. And I enjoyed the being outdoors. We were out living outside all the time. But the people were an unusually rough group of people, very difficult. They would fight with each other, stab each other. I mean, I've never seen people like that before or since. They had come right out of Korea. They were battle, it sounds trite, but battle-hardened. They really were. And I wanted to get out of that. And so I met a guy who was the head of the 5th Air Force Band, professional musician, a major. Told him I wanted to get out and thought that I'd like to be involved in radio, Armed Forces Radio Service. He said, well, if you really want that, I'll get you out, because my very best friend is General so-and-so, with whom I play golf once a week. This was the general who was the commanding officer of all of Japan, and I was out of there in 2 days. And I went to Tokyo. I was given a radio station in a city called Niigata. I had 8 or 10 military guys who, from various services, who were professional radio people, and we ran a radio station. We were on the air 18 hours a day, broadcasting to Americans in that part of Japan. And it was so good that I brought my fiance over, and we were married there, and lived there for a year together before I had to come home. So I was lucky, very, very lucky, and had a marvelous experience over there. Came back, went to law school for 6 months, hated every minute of it at Dickinson Law School up in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Said, what I really want to be is a newspaper reporter. I went to the paper in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, got myself a reporter's job, and then said I needed formal training, and so I went to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. Worked for the AP in New York for a year after that. During school, I worked at the Long Island Press at night. And then was offered a job back at Columbia in their public affairs operations. And newspapers paid zero almost in those days, and they offered me a lot more money, and so I went there. And then I wrote a letter to a man named Lion Rogers at Johns Hopkins, who was the head of the placement office, and I said, if you could ever use a person with my background, I'd love to come back to Hopkins. 3 years later, he got in touch with me and said that Milton Eisenhower was looking for a person with my background, that Eisenhower had always hired people with newspaper training as his assistant.
Mm-hmm.
Are we okay?
Mm-hmm, we're fine.
So I came back I came down here in the spring of 1961 to meet him, and we hit it off fine, and then I came in September 61.
Now, was Eisenhower already here then?
He had been here since 1956, so he was here 5 years.
Uh-huh.
He had brought an assistant named Keith Spaulding with him from Penn State, and Eisenhower could burn you out because you lived his life and you lived your own. You tried to live your own. And it was very, very difficult. And after 5 years, Keith was tired and felt the need for someone else to help out. And so he convinced Eisenhower to let him do some other things. And they hired me. And I lasted in that very intimate job with him about 4 years. And then you just, it's just a feeling that comes of both of you. And then he made me secretary of the university, and I did a lot of special assignments for him. But we hired another assistant named Wayne Anderson, who came in and sort of took my day-to-day kind of role that I had had. Mm-hmm. But I kept very, very close to Eisenhower, and really until his death after he had retired. He was a great mentor. It was one of the very, very lucky events in one's life. You look to what are those moments in your life that you really are defining moments, and certainly the working with him, for him, was one for me.
Introduce me to Milton Eisenhower. Tell me all
about
him.
Oh, man. Milton was a very, I think we would say, buttoned-up person. He was, in his appearance, he was always a coat and tie kind of person. He was chosen, I don't know however selections are made, one of the best-dressed men in America for 4 or 5 years in a row. Of course, he was the brother of the president, so he got a lot of public attention that way. He had been president of Penn State and Kansas State before that. He started out as a newspaper reporter after college. He had spent a year or so in Edinburgh in Scotland as a vice consul. He had been an assistant to the Secretary of Agriculture, a man named Jardine, who was a Kansan like Milton was. And Milton was better known in Washington for a period of time. He went on to become the director of public affairs for the Agriculture Department. And it is said that Milton was better known than Ike was in Washington for quite a while, that Ike was Milton's brother rather than the other way around. There were five Eisenhower brothers. Milton was a very warm, big smile. He had a kind of a large mouth and large teeth. And he would give you that. It was a very similar grin to General Eisenhower's grin. They looked, when they smiled, they looked very similar. Very, very warm guy. Everyone liked him immensely. He was very quick with numbers. I remember that. The story that when he first came to Hopkins, he looked over a whole page of numbers, something dealing with building new buildings or what the annual report or whatever it was, and found a mistake. And the people in the controller's office were just beside themselves that this man could come in with no background and pick out a mistake. And so they were always very careful after that. He was an excellent writer. He always talked about writing logically so that things flowed smoothly. He had an ego. I think it was under control for most people on the outside, but when you were close to him, you knew what an ego he had.
And how did that manifest itself?
Well, just, he could be offended if he wasn't paid proper homage for whatever. I can't remember specific instances, but I do know he had an ego. But most people in that position do. And, I mean, you have to. He was very demanding of people around him. We worked very hard, and we spent a lot of time on the job. In those days, you worked on Saturday mornings as well as Monday through Friday. Worked till noon. And he had a son and a daughter. The son, there was a contemporary of mine. Turns out we were in the same company in the Army in Fort Benning, Georgia for a while. His daughter, who died much too young, I think she was 49 when she died, of breast cancer, the same thing that took her mother at the same age, which was very unusual and unhappy. And Milton, when she died, Milton told me that was one of the greatest losses he could possibly imagine. He never really got over it. He was very close to Ike, and when Ike left the presidency, he moved to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, which is very close here. And Milton would spend a lot of time at the house in Gettysburg, and Ike would come down here and spend time. The first time I met Ike, I was totally shocked. It was one of those Saturday mornings, and I was in a little, tiny little office. We were in Homewood House in those days, and Milton was in what is now called the Green Room. I suppose it's the East Room in the Homewood House on the main floor. I was in a little sort of a chamber room next door to him. And Milton was in the office, his office, and I was there in mine. And all of a sudden, who walks in my office but General Eisenhower by himself, comes in, puts his hand out and says, "Hi." And "You must be Ross Jones," and Milton's assistant. And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he sat on the corner of my desk. And I don't know what we talked about. I was so nervous, I don't think I could remember. but he was a wonderful guy, just terrific. And then he went into Milton's office, and they went off for the rest of the day.
Did he come very often?
He came often. He came often, and I would see him over at Nichols' house, although we didn't call it Nichols' house in those days. The reason it's called Nichols' house is because a trustee who encouraged Milton to come from Penn State, Tom Nichols, said that he would build Milton a house if he would come, because Milton had always lived in institutional housing at Penn State and Kansas State. So Tom modeled it after his own house called Rolling Ridge out in the valley, Green Spring Valley. Although it's a scaled down version of his place. So Ike used to come down there, and I spent some time with them on occasion, just over lunch, just the three of us. It was amazing in the house. One time, at the end of the 1964 Republican nomination, it was in California. And Ike and Mrs. Eisenhower, who did not like to fly, came by train to Harrisburg, which is the closest place to Gettysburg. And Milton said he was going to go up and have breakfast with them on their car, and would I like to go up. So we drove up to a railroad siding in Harrisburg, and I got on the car with them. And so the four of us had breakfast on the train, served by this famous Sergeant Money, who was his valet all during the war, and steak and eggs and all this sort of thing. And I was just part of the group. I couldn't believe it. And talking about election, the nomination processes and, you know, everything, the issues of the day. And at one point, Mrs. Eisenhower asked me if I liked flowers, and I told her I did. And she said, "Well, come with me." And we went to what I think you call the observation car, which was attached. Observation car must have had 200 orchid plants in it, because all across the country, every place they stopped, people put flowers on the train, and she had all these flowers. So she says, "You take as many as you can carry." So Milton and I carried him off and put him in the trunk of his car, and my wife and I had orchids for years. We couldn't really care for them well, and they finally went the way of all things like that. But it was a nice gesture.
Oh, my goodness.
And then when Ruth Eisenhower, Milton's daughter, got married, Ike and Mamie were there, and we spent some time with them at the wedding. Reception was right here at Evergreen House. So those were wonderful memories. And Milton was always being asked by other beyond Hopkins. Just before I came to Hopkins, I think the Bay of Pigs had happened, or something happened with Cuba, where we were able to maybe recover some people who were captured. I just forget the story at the moment, though the history would make it very clear if you to read about it. Where Milton was asked by Kennedy, I think, to head a thing called Tractors for Freedom. And I think it was to free prisoners from the Bay of Pigs by sending them farm equipment. And Milton agreed to head it. And a lot of people were protesting that. Just before I arrived, it must have been about 1960, 58, 59, 60. And apparently the tons of mail came in to Hopkins protesting or supporting one or the other, but tons of mail came to him. And then when Lincoln, when Lyndon Johnson became president, he and Milton had known each other back in Milton's agriculture days when Johnson, they both came to Washington at the same time, Johnson to the Congress and Milton agriculture, and Johnson would call on him frequently for advice, and he would go over to the White House. And one occasion, Milton chaired a Panama Canal Commission, or I can't remember whether he chaired or was serving on it. And the notion was to build a new canal across the isthmus by nuclear power, that is, blowing it up and having a sea level canal. And Milton spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 years on that, and I went to all the meetings with him. He took me everywhere. Everywhere he went, I went. And so I got a view of the world in a little more than just being an assistant at Johns Hopkins. And so I was able to meet Lyndon Johnson and go to the White House, and you know, those kinds of things, which just sort of expanded my horizons.
I should say so. I need to turn the tape over.
Okay. Shall I continue?
Absolutely.
Milton was a huge baseball fan and a strategist on baseball. I mean, he really knew the game. And a man named Zan Krieger, for whom the Krieger School is now named, was his best friend. And Zan was a part owner, I believe, in those days of the Orioles, and would take Milton to the games. Once in a while, I would be able to go. They had an extra ticket. He'd take me. Same with the Baltimore Colts. Zan was involved with that organization also. But Milton loved baseball, and I remember the first time that I went to a lacrosse game with him, with Milton. Baseball season was on, and he had his portable radio, and he'd be listening to the radio while he's watching the lacrosse game. And he would cheer when there was something happening on the radio, when nothing was happening on the lacrosse field, and people would wonder what was going on. He was very hyper about it. Sometimes he would get so nervous and upset about what was happening. For example, if the manager wouldn't pull a pitcher out who was not doing well or something like that, he'd simply turn it off. He couldn't listen anymore. He really loved the game. When he retired, what are you going to give a man like Milton Eisenhower? Well, one of the things we gave him was a gold lifetime pass to the Orioles, which they conspired with us to.
Oh, what a great idea!
To give him, and then the American League, not wanting to be outshone, gave him an American League pass.
Oh my God!
The museum, the Eisenhower Museum in Abilene. He sent a lot of his stuff there, everything. Also, I was talking earlier about no degree. Milton only had a bachelor's degree.
You're kidding.
No, that's right. He never got a doctorate.
How?
But he had about 36 or 40 honorary degrees, so he said he didn't mind being called doctor. He said he thought he earned it.
That's no, amazing.
No, he did not.
Well, how on earth did he rise to where he
was? Well, he started at Kansas State, and he had the blessing of this man Jardine, who was a leading political figure in Kansas, and he was just he's a very smart guy, and as I said earlier, a very personable individual.
Fascinating.
And of course, when his brother was president, I mean, he had a little extra clout, I think it's fair to say, but he did it on his own. There's a famous story that, you know, that Milton was supposed to be president of Columbia University, but they made a mistake and chose Ike. I don't believe that. But he was held in esteem in higher education circles. By the time I connected with him, he had been around for so long in higher education that he'd seen it all, sort of, as we say today, been there, done that. And I was very enthusiastic and about my job and about him, and I couldn't imagine why he never wanted to go to any of the big national meetings where all the presidents were gathered and so forth, and it bored him. And I would say, oh, Dr. Eisenhower, you should go to the American Council on Education meeting. Look at this wonderful topic they're going to discuss. And he'd say, oh, a bunch of blowhards there, whatever, just didn't. In retrospect, I feel that way now about my own, those kinds of things don't hold out the excitement at this stage in life that they did when you were younger. And I appreciate it.
Did he have a good rapport with students?
Oh, excellent. Outstanding. He said when he first came to the campus that everybody walked around the campus with their head down. They never looked at anybody and never said hello. And he tried to personally change that. He lived on campus, so he's walking around the campus a lot. Then he had another thing he did was he had a little light next to his study, outside light, right? And there was a door leading into his study. And whenever that light was on, students knew that they could come over and talk to him and spend some time with him, and they did. And so there is a group of alumni out there around the country today who spent time with Eisenhower in his home, talking about whatever they wanted to talk about. And they were very rewarding times for him. I think he was kind of lonely. His daughter lived with him just a very short time. She was at Swarthmore College after they moved here. And then she got married and moved out. He had a wonderful housekeeper named Margie Morgan, and her husband Charles drove for him. But I think he was lonely, so he did. He had a wonderful rapport with students, absolutely outstanding. I used to go with him for lunch, probably 3 or 4 days a week, to Nichols' house, and Margie would make a light lunch. Milton tried to watch his weight, and so usually it would be a salad-type lunch and iced tea or something like that. But beforehand, we always had Dubonnet on the rocks with a twist of lemon. And I often think today I couldn't possibly do that. I'd go to sleep immediately, but I did. And he would have one or two, and he'd be fine in the afternoon. But and then we would eat on the what are not so popular today, but were then TV tables. And he wanted me to always to remind me, he said, now these are what Ike and Mamie use in the White House. And they were especially nice, big and nice. And Margie would serve us on those tables. I remember one time walking across near the Hopkins Club, walking over to lunch with him, and he stepped out in front of a car, and I put my hand up to stop him. And he said, they wouldn't dare hit me. I said, I'm not so sure. Another thing about Milton was that every time his name was in the paper, he would give a speech or whatever, you could almost guarantee that in the next couple of days, you'd get some sort of a communication from somebody crazy. A letter, a visit, whatever. And I remember one lovely looking lady coming in to see me, had to see Dr. Eisenhower because she had to get a message to Ike. I mean, she was probably in her 70s, beautifully dressed, said she had just gotten off a bus from Oregon. I don't know whether she did or not, but she was absolutely out of it. And but he had been in the paper just a few days before, and I guess it got her attention. Another time, a man was threatening us. We wouldn't put up with it today, but he was threatening to bomb the university. That's what he said he was going to do, bomb the university. And I remember ushering him out of Homewood House one time, but another time he sort of waited for Milton and me as we were leaving the office, and this was in the wintertime and it was dark. And out near the little parking lot near Homewood House. And as we walked by, he said, "Dr. Eisenhower, Dr. Eisenhower," and he began sort of chasing us. And Milton said, "Let's get out of here." And so I said, "Well, let me take," I said, "I know how to lose him, because I can go through these academic buildings," and he doesn't know, and you don't know, but I know how to do it. So we began walking fast, and I remember, and he could really, he wasn't much taller than I, but he was a little taller. And he said to me, "Is that all faster those short legs of yours will carry you? Let's get moving." So we did lose him eventually. And the next morning, this man was outside of Nichols' house waiting again for him in his car. And Milton called the police, and it turned out he was just a mentally unbalanced person, had no bomb or anything. Mm-hmm. And they lived in Baltimore County someplace, and they said, you know, just never be on that campus again. But we had a file called the 1000 file, and that was for all the crazy letters that came in. We wouldn't throw them away, but we would keep them, and they're still around, I would think. I don't know.
Is that what the 1000?
We still have one. We still have one in the president's office today. I just continued it. That when letters come in from people clearly unbalanced, we put it in the file.
Julie made mention of the 1000 file, but I didn't know what she meant.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll have to find some gem.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. Now, a while ago, you told me something that I guess I knew, but I'd like to hear more about, that the administrative offices were in Homewood House.
We were in Homewood House. I think maybe for Homewood House, I think they were in Remsen Hall, part of Remsen Hall. And at some point, maybe under President Bronk or maybe even under Bowman, they moved to Homewood House.
So what was that like?
Oh, it was wonderful. I was there 8 years. Milton was there the whole time of his tenure. It was terrific. It was lovely to go in there each morning. And very gracious. The place wasn't changed very much, although he dropped the ceiling in his office so he could have fluorescent lighting above the ceiling, but it didn't do any damage to the place. He just put in these, you know, framework for fluorescent lighting. But the rest of the place was pretty much like it was. And it was very nice. We were in there. Dr. Schaffer was at the other end of the building. And the provost, and if you can believe it, the whole development office was in there. Upstairs, there was a fellow named Chick Estill who ran development for all of East Baltimore, and Bill Lachlan, who ran development for every place else in Hopkins. There were a couple of secretaries. There was a guy named Cliff Culp, who came as a sort of accountant, but developed into being the, because he didn't have enough to do, decided we ought to get in good relationships with foundations, and he developed our foundations program. I think the name of the first planned giving officer was Bob Pittard, and I think that was it, and he was in there. And there was a woman named Anna Ray Suter, who's still around, who was the first records and research person. And a very young girl came named Juanita Dyer, and Juanita is still here in development. And every now and then I remind her that I can still see her coming up the steps as a little girl just out of high school. And there were a few other women who kept the records, and that was it. Today, there are more than 250 people in development in this university. It's astounding to me. Just astounding.
Now, is it astounding that there are more than 200 people, or is it astounding that you all fit into Homewood House?
Well, both. I mean, it gives you some idea of the scale of the operation in those days. I think there's no doubt that the investment in additional people over the years has paid off big time. Just no doubt about it.
Now
that's something else about Milton, I should say, and that is he was very tight, very tight. He did not want to have... Hopkins faculty was very controlling in those days, and Milton had enormous respect for them. And maybe, you know, the lack of the PhD, I don't know whether that ever played into his thinking or not, but he paid great respect to that faculty. And the thing the faculty do not like is an abundance of administrators. They say the money could be used for their purposes rather than administration. And that's understandable. So Milton held down the administration probably too much because the times were changing and pressures were such, particularly on reporting to the government, on government expenditures and that kind of thing. So that when he left in 1967, a new president, Lincoln Gordon, came in, but he hired a vice president named Bruce Partridge, who was a sort of professional administrator who had come from the University of Delaware. Well, Partridge felt, and probably justly to some degree, that we needed a lot more staff, and so the staffing began to grow at that time. But Milton held the lid very, very tight.
And as a result, you moved out of Homewood House?
Well, no, we didn't move out of Homewood House until, about 1970, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that was an effort to consolidate all of the, there was administration in Whitehead Hall, there was administration in Homewood House, maybe some other places, and we wanted to try to bring it all together.
Uh-huh.
And it was a useful thing to do. And then the deans of the Homewood campus moved into Homewood House, again, freeing up space. But an interesting, another Eisenhower story is that when Lincoln Gordon, I'll just digress for a moment, became president, he was the third choice, unfortunately, as the selection committee looked around. They wanted a man first named Alex Hurd, who was the president of Vanderbilt and then the Ford Foundation. And I can't remember whether Hurd was still at Vanderbilt or had just gone to Ford, but he didn't feel he could make a move. And then there was a man named David Truman, who was the provost at Columbia. And he thought, and rightly so, that he was going to be president of Columbia after Grayson Kirk retired. Well, then the big explosion took place at Columbia, all the student unrest. Kirk had to go, and Truman was captured in that same problem. And so he had turned down the Hopkins job, but he didn't get to be president of Columbia either. Went on to become president, I think, of Smith or Mount Holyoke, someplace there. Anyhow, these were two outstanding people. Could have been happy with either one of them. And then they had Lincoln Gordon on the list. And Lincoln was an outstanding professor at Harvard, whom John Kennedy had picked to be his ambassador to Brazil. And then he came back after a five-year stint there and was, let me say, Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs or something, Latin Affairs or whatever it was. And on paper, he had the qualities that the university was, that the trustees were looking for. I might say that there were some trustees who at the end of Milton's tenure, it's interesting how when you're about finished, or you've left, just left, people will begin to nitpick. And some people, I think, were not happy that he didn't have a PhD and sort of suppressed that during the good. But as he was leaving, what we need next, said they, is someone with a doctorate, someone the faculty can really, you know, relate to and so forth. The first two people I mentioned to you did have doctorates, and then Lincoln Gordon had a doctorate. So he had a doctorate, he had been an ambassador, he had been an assistant secretary of state, and Hopkins liked that kind of international aspect. I mean, Milton was an ambassador at large to Latin America as Ike's representative. Bowman, as president, had been in World War, had helped break up Europe at the end of World War I, so there was that sort of tradition. Bronk was an internationally known scientist. And so Gordon was chosen, and I remember the night before we were going to announce it, I called the chairman of the search committee, Harrison Winter, Judge Harrison Winter. Time magazine had come out with a story about Lincoln Gordon that very day, and it was not flattering. And I remember one line in it said something about when he gets up to speak, his staff cringes because they don't know what he's going to say. I called Harrison and I said, you know, you really have to know this before we come out with this tomorrow. You have to be aware of it. I don't remember what he said, but So we chose him, and Lincoln was a wonderful man as a personality. He's a nice man, smart man. But he had no ability to terminate his conversation. He talked forever. And I think it was in that story or some other story, it said that he didn't speak in sentences, he spoke in books, or, you know, or whatever, chapters. I mean, he just could not terminate. And he had these interminable meetings. It was not a good time. And I can talk about more about him later if you want. But among other things, we had built this building, this Garland Hall, and so Milton comes back just as Lincoln leaves, and we're about to move in to Garland Hall, and we had spent X thousands of dollars for new furniture, and the university was in a deficit. Milton had left $2.5 million dowry for Lincoln Gordon. He went right through that, and we owed $4.5 million. We were in debt $4.5 million, which in those days was a lot. So first thing Milton did was cancel the furniture order. And the furniture was on the trucks coming to Baltimore. He said, I don't care, cancel it. So I don't know what they ever did, but the furniture all went back, and he said, everybody bring their own furniture. And that's what we did. And the second thing he did was he wiped out the in-house food service at Levering Hall and put in automatic sandwich and beverage vendors. And they called it, what did they call it? Something like the, I don't know. But it was not a very complimentary comment.
So it was an automatic?
Sort of thing. I think they called it the Purple Palace or something. I don't know. It was really, but the point was, we've got to stop this hemorrhaging of spending, and he made the point very clear. But that was vintage Eisenhower. He knew how to slash and burn.
Dare say.
Yeah.
Turn those trucks around.
Yeah.
Well, now we're kind of skating over a lot of stuff here.
Yeah.
And of course, I know there's a lot of stuff to cover.
Yeah.
But that Lincoln Gordon time was an interesting time for a lot of reasons.
I think anybody who came to succeed Eisenhower would have had a hard time because he was so beloved, and he imprinted his style on this place. So it would have been hard. But Lincoln had these failings of not ever having run a university. I figured out later that being an ambassador doesn't mean anything in terms of running a major organization, because you have the bureaucrats there who are running it, whether the ambassador is there or not, how many times they change him, but it doesn't make any difference. The bureaucrats run it. So he really didn't run anything. And to come into a complicated place like this, where he applied his brains very often more than his instinct, you know, to do quickly, move quickly and do the right thing, was very difficult for him. He was a sweet guy, very nice man. But he just wasn't, this was not his cup of tea. It wasn't his wife's cup of tea. Her name was Allison. Very unhappy while she was here.
Well, there was a lot going on then, well, too. Let's talk about the politics.
Well, all the student unrest took off during those days. But also, Lincoln got in trouble with the faculty in terms of budget and with these deficits that were growing. And I remember those of us in the administration, it was just devastating. We're called before the faculty. We had these sessions in Remsen Hall. There's a big lecture room there called Remsen One. And we had to stand down there in the pit and answer questions to the faculty about our budgets. And it was very, very difficult and nasty, just nasty. And the president wasn't in any position to defend us. He just lost credibility. So, and then you had all the student unrest, and he was a kind of a feisty guy who was wanting to take these people on. He had bullhorns out there, speaking to these crowds of people. And then students would go over to Nichols' house where he and his wife lived, and they'd, in the middle of the night, and they'd get up, and Lincoln would come out, with his bathrobe on, trying to settle things down. Steps of Homewood House, I remember, arguments and the students lying down in the hallways of Homewood House. Tents out on the lawn in front of the library, tent cities set up for periods of time. So there were, but nothing as serious as at Harvard and as at Columbia and some of the other places. Physical damage.
Does Hopkins have a history of being politically involved, or did this come?
Hopkins students generally are not politically involved.
So how did this grow? You were a witness to this.
How did it grow?
Tell me how these events came to pass.
Well, I mean, I think the Hopkins students were aware of what was going on other campuses, and certainly the issues were always in the newspaper every day. Vietnam and Cambodia, particularly. I won't say it's exactly copycat, but there is a kind of a thing that happens in campuses all across the country. Kent State happened. Mm-hmm. People were very, very upset. And again, the archives will show you, there are pictures in the Hopkins magazine. That's one time, I think it's the only time I ever got into a real argument with Lincoln Gordon. I was in charge of among other things in those days, of the magazine. And the editor did a very straightforward report on what happened on the campus at some incidents. I remember there was a big march from the upper quadrangle down toward Shriver Hall with banners. It's sort of a classic picture, holding up banners. And Lincoln thought that shouldn't have been reported. We ought to have more control over the magazine in order to keep that sort of thing from going out. And it was a Saturday morning. I remember him coming in and beginning. He's always had a pipe. He was puffing on his pipe and began raising his voice and getting very agitated. And I was telling him I didn't agree with him. I thought it'd be a mistake. He couldn't cover things like that up. And he began yelling at me, and I said to him, I said, "Lincoln, are you yelling at me?" and that took the wind out of his sails, and he calmed down and sort of sputtered and said he didn't mean to, but he was very upset about it.
Well, ultimately, did the magazine publish?
Oh, it was already out.
It was out.
He was already out. He was looking ahead to the next time, whatever. But Elise Hancock said that she characterized my style with the magazine as having a light hand on the throttle. And I always have liked that because that's what I did. I had to fire one editor of the magazine because he just went way overboard in being super critical of the university and its financial management. And I just didn't think that's the place of the magazine to do that. It's not a free press. But on the other hand, it certainly must report issues like student protest and so forth.
I can't imagine ignoring it.
No.
I can't imagine the alumni weren't wondering what was happening here.
No. So Lincoln's time was very stormy. I'll never forget the day that there was a delegation of faculty who came in to Homewood House, marched by my door, went in and closed his door, and essentially told him that they lost confidence in him, that their next stop was to visit the chairman of the board, Bob Harvey, to tell him. The amazing thing, Mame, was that was in the morning. I went over to the Hopkins Club for lunch, and as I was leaving, Lincoln Gordon was coming in with the editor of the magazine for lunch. And there was no problem at that time between them. And he was buoyant and friendly, and you would never have known what he had been through that morning, ever. I mean, it was amazing to me. I would have gone home and hidden in the closet, I think, if the faculty had told me that I was out from their point of view.
Maybe he was relieved.
Maybe so. I don't know. But he was gone just like that. And they called Eisenhower, who was living right near the campus, and asked him if he would pick it up for a time in order to carry the ball between when then they could find a new president. And then Eisenhower called me. I went over and we talked a lot about what was going on. We had long time chat about it. Interestingly, Lincoln had hired Stephen Muller to become provost. And this was March when all this happened, and Steve maybe was hired maybe in February. I can't remember exactly. This was in 1971, I think. And Steve was coming down here to look at Baltimore with his wife and two daughters, and the girls were in a motel out in Towson someplace. Steve and Margie were looking for housing and whatever. They were out to dinner. So when they came back to the motel, the girl said, "Daddy, you need to know something that we just saw on television that Dr. Gordon has resigned." And this is in March. And Milton said to the trustees, "I'll come back with a couple of conditions. But one of the conditions is that Steve Muller cannot wait till July 1. He's got to come now from Cornell." And so Steve did come and began to really kind of take over pretty quickly. And I've sort of lost my train of thought. Well, Lincoln wasn't here very long. Once Steve came, Lincoln left, and then we did a search for the president, but Steve made such an impression, such a positive impression on the trustees in a very short time that they said, "Well, why do we have to look further? We have somebody right here." And so it was 9 months that Milton was interim president and Steve was provost.
Now, before we move on into Mueller, There's at least one more thing that I know about from the Eisenhower era that I want to hear your story. You told me a few months ago about when Martin Luther King came to campus.
Yeah.
Can you tell me that again?
Martin Luther King came, as strange as it sounds, Mame, we didn't pay as much attention to him. I didn't. Because I think it's probably fair to say he was one of several people who were leading the African American protests at that time. I believe Chester Wickwire might have been responsible for bringing him here. That's something, if you ever talk, you need to ask about that. But I met him. I remember meeting him backstage, and I don't remember his talk being, terribly special. It just didn't carry the aura that it would have later, and particularly as he got closer to his death. He did a lot more after he was here. I do remember George Wallace even more, because Milton was very upset about the fact that Wallace had been invited to come to the campus. And I don't remember who invited him. But Milton was very upset about it, and suggested to the students that they sit on their hands and not applaud him. And he would not go, personally, would not go to the event. And but I went, and I sat on the front row. And when I got to the Shriver Hall, I looked at the stage, and there were probably 20 chairs lined up, armchairs lined up on the stage, empty. And then Wallace came out, and then he began, he said, "I want you to meet some of my friends." And they would come out and sit in these chairs, and they were all ethnic, the various kinds of ethnic friends. My friend, my Polish friend, my Czech friend, my whatever, you name it, my Irish friend, my Jewish friend, on and on. And somebody in the balcony hollered at him, "Where's your nigger?" And he looked at this lily white audience and said, "Where's yours?" And from that moment on, he had them in the palm of his hand. It was amazing. It was electric. I'll never, ever forget that feeling.
So let's talk about that. Where were Johns Hopkins
niggers? They weren't around. They just were not around. We talked about Ernie Bates earlier, who graduated in 58. There was another young man named Victor Dates who graduated in 1960. I mean, there were, you could name them on one hand.
So how did Hopkins embrace integration? How did
that
happen?
Well, it was slow. I mean, it was slow. I remember that one of the things I always sort of related to the Homewood community, and one of the things that we wanted to stop was discrimination in housing, off-campus housing. At one point, we had about 800 people who said they'd like to rent rooms or apartments to Hopkins students. And they filled out little cards, and on those cards they could discriminate if they wanted to. And so I wrote a letter on behalf of the university to all landlords saying no more discrimination. And that number, 800, dropped to around 200 overnight. It was the only time in my life I ever got hate mail at home, nigger lover and that sort of thing. But that was one of the early things that we did, was to try to stop that. When we did, eliminated it. But there were lots of little incidents along the way. I remember a graduate student wife lived in the Bradford Apartments, 33rd and St. Paul. And in the Bradford Apartments, we had a hairdresser, in the public hairdresser, leasing that woman's space in the basement of the ground floor of Bradford Apartments. she would not do this woman's hair. Well, I mean, this woman and her husband, who's in physics, rightly so, got very upset, and I remember going over there and doing the best I could to say that we would not tolerate that anymore, that kind of tension with this woman. And finally, I believe we pushed the woman out. So they were difficult. They were difficult times. But I like to think we did the right thing. When Milton, toward the end of his career, we hired an alumnus named Victor Dates, and Victor worked with me. One of his first jobs was to help promote a scholarship fund for African Americans, and we called it the Difference Fund, Make a Difference. And we began to recruit African American undergraduate students. And, you know, slowly but surely it began to work. And by the time that Lincoln became president, there were black African American, there were African American undergraduate students, and some of them were leading some of the protests.
Okay, we're at the end of this tape.
Okay.
It's Mame Warren. It's June 18th, 1999. I'm in Baltimore with Ross Jones. This is tape two. And we were just talking about integration, but my goodness, Ross, things have changed around here. How did that transformation come?
I think just time and commitment. Steve Muller was very committed to attracting more African-American students at all levels. I think it's interesting to look back. It's largely driven by individuals who are committed. And I can't think of exactly now who they were, but there were people in the medical school who were committed to bring in more young African Americans to train to be doctors in that program. I think Levi Watkins was one of the early people to help push that. And he was a great role model. And that helped to make it believable, credible, that you really were interested in promoting the cause of African American students.
But not just black students, and this place is as multiracial, multi-everything.
Well,
as any place I've ever seen.
I don't know how it compares. My hunch is that most of the major research universities now around the country have a similar look. But Baltimore, being Baltimore, and, you know, I think it was a little harder. I do know that for many African American students in the North, Baltimore was not an attractive place to come. And I would say in the South also, they wanted to go farther north. It did not appear attractive to them, particularly because we could not guarantee 4 years of housing, and they had to live in the community. And they were worried about where they could find a place to live in the neighborhood.
Steve Muller.
Yep.
Let's talk about Steve Muller.
Oh, my. I mentioned to you that Steve had come from Cornell. He had gotten his PhD at Cornell. He had been director of their International Studies Center, or whatever. I'm not sure exactly what the title was. But I think the president there, I guess it was Jim Perkins, had recognized in Steve a tremendous ability to reach out beyond the institution and be very articulate and to really be an outstanding public relations figure for the institution. So he made him vice president for public affairs. There was a search committee headed by a person from medicine named Al Leninger, who recommended Steve. I thought it was for provost. I thought it was a very interesting recommendation. A guy, he did have the doctorate, but here's a guy who comes out of public affairs to be provost of the university. It's interesting. Although, let me say parenthetically, we're talking about no PhDs. The provost of this university for many years, Stuart McCauley, had no PhD. He was a Hopkins undergraduate, had played lacrosse, had been at the Baltimore Sun as a reporter for maybe 10 or 12 years, and Isaiah Bowman brought him here to be his sort of assistant and provost, and he remained many years in that position. But anyhow, here comes Steve Muller as provost, and then I told you the story of how it happened with Lincoln Gordon leaving and Milton taking over for a year. Steve was very antsy during those 8 or 9 months. He could feel that he was going to be elected president, and he was anxious to get on with it. And I can remember, because I was staffing the search committee, he would grab me and say, "Hey, why don't those guys move it? What are they, you know, what are they taking? What's taking so long?" And so forth. But finally, they did decide to make it formal and to invite him to be president. And it was a great period for the university. It was outstanding. Steve hit the floor running, and he was particularly interested in development and raising money. And within a few months after he was here, we launched a called the Hopkins Hundreds campaign. I should say also that he was not happy with the person who was running development when he came here. This fellow had been hired by Lincoln Gordon, and neither Lincoln nor this person really had any idea of how to do development. And we had geared up for a campaign, hired a lot of people, but nothing had happened. And so when Steve came in, he and Milton thought that I ought to run development, in addition to the other things I was already doing. And so I did, and I took it on. And among the first few weeks, I had to fire about 14, 15 people who were really excess baggage and sort of start again. A very unpleasant time. But Steve said, what we need is, you know, rejuvenate this place. We need some money. We need to do some new things. And the university's 100th anniversary was coming up in 1976. This was about 1972, 73. And so we decided on this name, the Hopkins Hundreds. We wanted to celebrate the 100th anniversary, and we wanted $100 million, which was the largest amount of money any institution was seeking in those days. And we wanted to endow 100 professorships. That was the purpose of it. And we took the Board of Trustees down to Williamsburg to launch this thing on a weekend. Steve, the idea was to essentially lock them up for a couple of days and talk about the need. And Steve's charm, again, just rose to the top. We had a formal black tie dinner in the Williamsburg Inn. I remember Steve at a high dais, and only by candlelight. This room was only lighted by candlelight. Huge candelabra around. And Steve got up with no notes and gave the most motivational speech about Johns Hopkins and the need to get behind this fundraising campaign that I've ever heard. I'll never forget it. And he had people, you know, right there. So we launched it, and we had outside counsel, a firm named Ketchum. Dave Ketchum was a friend of Steve's. He was a Cornell alumnus, so Steve knew him, trusted him. He ran a big firm that did this sort of thing. He assigned a fellow named Charlie Trimble to work with us full-time for the whole length, 3 years of the campaign. And we had a good go, and we did a little over $100 million in about 3 years. It just buoyed people's morale and sense of it, that if we decided we wanted to do something to accomplish it, we could. And it raised Steve's credits among the trustees dramatically. Al Decker was the chairman of that campaign, and was either the first or second person to give $1 million to the campaign. I remember Steve calling me and my going down to his office, and Al had just called him and said he's going to give $1 million, which was, you know, now people give $100 million, but $1 million in those days was big money for us. And so it was very successful. Steve was a doer, a mover, had tremendous amount of creativity. And as I've said again, I'm boring you with it, but it was so articulate and so presentable on behalf of the university. An extraordinary guy.
Well, you know, I certainly was around during the Mueller years, and he seemed to be synonymous with Johns Hopkins.
Yeah.
And goodness knows, he had such a wonderful reputation in the larger community.
Yeah. You know, the Baltimore Sun started a Man of the Year thing during his time, and Steve was the first Man of the Year of the Baltimore Sun.
I bet he was.
Just back to integration for a little bit, Steve was very concerned about that. And there was a young man named Jakey Hall, Joseph Hall, nicknamed Jakey, who was working, had begun to work in the community in East Baltimore for Hopkins. And somehow, I don't know how they met, but Steve grabbed onto him, and Jakey became his assistant. And I always thought it was a great bridge with the African-American community. I mean, Jakey was a Baltimorean, had a master's in social work, was a very affable African-American fellow, and served Steve very well in that role of liaison and so forth. You know, when people came to see the president, they saw Jakey, and it was a help. But we, you know, again, you have to go back and look at the record, Mame. I just can't give you chapter and verse of all the things that Steve instituted, but certainly he instituted the Mind-Brain Center that we have today. That was a notion of his that he pushed hard on, got the faculty behind him. The Nanjing Center was a sort of a knockoff of the Bologna Center. But again, he pushed hard on it. There were two major things, but bringing the university's endowment to a new level, and you know, putting us on solid footing after having had a deficit, a serious deficit during the Lincoln Gordon years, was a tremendous contribution. I would say also that he expanded the Board of Trustees, and in terms of women and geography and minorities, I mean, he had a sense of a much larger board, and one that was more representative of the institution. So we started, and I was very much in favor of this. I was secretary of the board in those days, and we started by adding people where we had larger concentrations of alumni, particularly in New York and in Washington. I mean, when Steve became president, and certainly when Milton was president, the Board of Trustees at Hopkins was a little local club. It was the blue stocking crowd of Baltimore. It was a prestigious organization with which to be associated. And they were of the same social level, primarily. There was, I think there was one Jewish guy on the board, Eli Frank, whose father, Judge Frank, was the first Jew on the board, and Eli was on. But you know, and so it was sort of token. No blacks, no women until Eisenhower. That was another one of his requirements. If he was going to come back, he wanted women on the board, and he wanted younger people. And so we created the young trustee slots, and Marjorie Lewiston was the first woman who came on. But Steve found this very insular, provincial kind of board, and said, "This it won't do, and we've got to enlarge it and make it more diverse, and also begin to bring in some trustees." Were not very generous. There were not major donors on the board in those days, and so it really took off under his leadership.
Sounds like quite a transformation.
It was a transformation. just no doubt about it.
The other word that comes up a lot when his name is brought up is global.
But well, he did. He thought he, as I mentioned earlier, he was a European, you know, sort of by birth and by instinct, and he thought worldwide. And he could speak in global terms, both about Hopkins and about world events. I attended a luncheon in Paris. I particularly feel grateful to Steve for having introduced me to Europe. I didn't know anything about Europe. Eisenhower, I think, went there only once, and I didn't go with him before I got here to Bologna. But Steve took me to Europe on several occasions, and we would visit with alumni and donors and, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm very grateful for that. But once Steve got there, he was a different guy. This is his home turf, you know. Anyhow, he gave this talk to the American community in Paris. I think at least a third of the people there were from our embassy. No notes, 45 minutes, of what will happen to Germany when the wall comes down. And this was probably 5 or 6 years before it came down. And an embassy officer who I was sitting next to said it was the most enlightened talk that he had ever heard. And forward thinking on the subject of what happens to Europe beyond Germany when they're united. Nobody was talking about
unification. Nobody was talking about it.
But then. That he had that ability to do that.
Fascinating.
He was, what do they say, thinking outside the box. Mm-hmm. Steve did that.
And I'm really looking.
And
forward
he was
to
and he was beloved by the faculty. They planted, the Homewood faculty planted a tree in his honor in front of the Hopkins Club. Unheard of. The president's here, but who cares? No, with Steve, they really liked him. His only problem, in my view, was he stayed around too long, and people began to take him for granted. Mm-hmm. And then he began being a little reckless, I think, in his expenditures. Although, today, we are the beneficiaries. The Bloomberg building broke the bank of arts and sciences. That was, without the Bloomberg building, we were okay. But that's larger than Gilman Hall. I mean, it's the largest building on the campus. And it cost a fortune. And that's when arts and sciences got into a really serious deficit situation. We had another plan on the books to build a huge administration building over on the Wyman Park lot. I kept the pictures and the artist's rendering of it for years in my office, just as a reminder that sometimes things don't happen like that, and that never did. there were other things I can't remember, but there were just a lot of expenditures. One of the good things that we brought all of the buildings on this campus and on other campuses up to snuff maintenance wise. You know the story of Yale. Yale was $1 billion behind in deferred maintenance a few years ago. Hopkins kept theirs up, but we spent money to do it. Mm-hmm. So while it was difficult and we had to work our way out of those deficits, Steve left the legacy of buildings and programs that I think the history will be very generous to him. At least I hope it will.
Me too. We're almost to
okay.
our deadline,
right.
our
okay.
self-imposed
sure,
deadline.
Sure.
I have one really yep. important question
okay.
that I just really want to hear your thoughts about.
All right.
What's the personality of Johns Hopkins? What makes this place what it is?
Well, I think I alluded to it earlier on. Remember that Hopkins was formed primarily as a graduate school. That's what the hope was, that we would advance knowledge, not just repeat knowledge. But we realized pretty soon on that you needed, the income from the undergraduates, to keep the place alive, keep the cash flow coming. But then you have to ask yourself, this is my view, you know, I don't know whether it's true or not, but you have to ask yourself, what is graduate education all about? And it seems to me that graduate education is independent study, independent thinking, self-starting, look for new ideas, you know, move ahead, don't be bogged down with the past. And a lot of flexibility and a lot of freedom to do your thing. And I've always maintained that that notion, that sense, maybe not articulated like that, but that pervades the place, starting with undergraduates who are given a lot of freedom, encouraged to think on their own and to develop on their own. Certainly true of graduate students. I think it's true of every faculty member. And because Hopkins is so decentralized, your departments are going to have that same feeling. We're going to do our thing. Your schools are going to have the arts and sciences, engineering, you name it. They're given their head to run and do the best thing they can. The deans are all responsible for the bottom line, raising money as well as expending it. And so you have this great collection of independent people, departments, schools, whose one unifying thread is to be as good as they possibly can, to be excellent. And they're encouraged to do it. And the people in the central administration are there to try to keep that going, to try to be sure that at least in the leadership, that they have excellent leadership, and then let whatever will be kind of flow down through the divisions right to the students. So I think, I've never been anywhere else, out of Columbia for 3 years, but that didn't really count. I don't know how it is elsewhere. But my sense is that Hopkins is pretty special in that willingness to let people do their own thing. And that the people who do best here, whether they're faculty or they're students, are people who like that. I do know that we did a study a few years ago, the trustees did, of about 14 or 15 other research universities, each of whom had a medical school. That was the criteria. And on one end of the poll, Hopkins and Harvard were the most decentralized. At the other end of the poll was Northwestern, where everything came in at the top. All the money, all the decisions, everything, and then filtered down through the, and then there were people in between. But it is an extraordinarily decentralized place, and I think decentralization assumes a lot of autonomy on the part of divisions and departments and students, faculty.
Well, that was a pretty good description, Ross. You must be in PR. You must have done this once or twice before.
I've often thought about it myself.
Well,
yeah.
I think it's a really good question, and to hear how much...
Other people will have different views.
Yes, maybe. Yes. And to hear how much agreement and what the various ideas are.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking forward to the
answer to that question. Yeah, good question.
All right, well, we're at our time limit. I have a zillion more questions.
I enjoyed it immensely, and I would... I mean, if you want to do it some